So welcome, everybody. Season three, episode three of the Shadow Dragon podcast. My name is Nico Dakins. I'm the director of Intelligence Collection Innovation. And today we're going to talk a lot about OSINT. But first, let's start by introducing every other member of this little podcast. Dan.
This is Daniel Clemens, founder and CEO of Shadow Dragon. Let's rock and roll.
All right. David.
David Cook, director of national security here at Shadow Dragon.
And hey, last, Nico. But certainly not least, Elliot.
Yeah, it's me. It's Elliot. I'm the CTO here. Obviously, we battle the internets. That's all we do. We just go out there. We find the data. That's all me and you do.
Yeah, well, and that's also, I think, a good starting topic because, well, we have these battles trying to improve our products at Shadow Dragon. Trying to improve our product line and make it better for our customers and people that do open source intelligence investigations. And last week, we rolled out the new version of Horizon, which I think is something that we are all very proud of. And by looking at the feedback of all the customers and also new people that wanted to be onboarded is something that we did very well. But I think it might be interesting for some people to know what it took to get here, where we are now. So, yeah. Elliot, can you maybe talk a little bit about the process without going into, let's say, all the secret sauce details that we don't want to share, but what it takes to build a tool that is basically capable of doing scalable open source intelligence investigations?
So one of the big problems that we see with a lot of tools in the market is the internet's not, it doesn't, it's not static. It always changes, right? And I mean, for example, one of the things we could talk about is like my kids, I've got kids, you know, and they're pretty young and they play on phones and do all that stuff. And they are on platforms that are new,
you know,
and in the last few months or weeks, it's been BeReal. That was what they were doing. And I'm not a big fan of those platforms, by the way, that's what's been popular. And so what we have to do with our product is we have to constantly adjust to the sort of the wave of the internet. It just kind of flows. It's like an ebb and flow of things. And so one of the things that makes our product pretty cool is, you know, we adjust to that. You know, we're always trying to figure out what that is. And so when we start talking about like our new platform launch, what we're really trying to do is make it easy for any investigator who's new or seasoned to be able to just, you know, go out and say, hey, I want to find guy number one. And they do it. And then the platform pops back that information as quick as possible. And we've had years and years and years of building that out. And so one of the things that I think it is, I would say the biggest advantage or the biggest thing we've done with our new product is it's just faster. It's just quicker to get to data. And that's, in my opinion, that's the most important thing for anybody who's researching something. And we're always obviously doing the battle with the internet, so
yeah,
we're always out there doing that.
I mean, I think faster is the prerogative that you guys have, and my goals are a little different. Spending a lot of time in the trenches on long form investigations, which was I needed a tool, and I figured I assume other analysts are out there that have the same need, where all of my capabilities are in one tool as much as possible. So I don't lose focus, because if you're like me, you probably have some like mild form of ADHD, right? So it's just the reality of doing sequential investigative work and then having to have this like big puzzle piece that's a visual spatial universe. And then you have to put together all the pieces together. So even the little subtle things, like, for instance, like when I would have to look up and change tools, change tabs, from a tool to look into another piece of information that I'm already analyzing, that kind of shifts a little bit of focus away from what I already was doing, and that kind of degrades the performance of focus, right? And so having things in Horizon, that was something that we needed ourselves, much like how we invented SocialNet many years ago. We needed to get data with SocialNet, and now with Horizon, we needed to be able to pivot and interact with that data in a little bit of a different way, and interact with it with geospatial type realities, right? So being able to visualize that in a way that makes sense, that's not, for lack of a better word, bullshit, right? Like we needed a little bit more, you know, geoint-ish visuals, along with the normal, you know, sequential link analysis process that you would need to do. And then that also enables us to kind of slice time, right? So typically with any kind of link analysis platform out there on the market, and this goes back all the way back to, you know, like your I2s of the day back in early 2000s, there's going to be a timeout value between you and your data. And that could be a database, that could be an HTTP web server, that could be a microservice, that could be a RESTful API. The way that we've architected things in Horizon helps the analyst not have to, or helps the link analysis platform not have to worry about time and the delivery of that data in a timely or untimely fashion. It can just go get it, put it in the background. You can get it quickly, or you could say, I want to, you know, get this at some later date, right? So that helps the analyst focus on the task at hand, as they've already delegated out collection capabilities different ways, you know. So,
well, and I think what you just said, it helps the analyst focus. And I think that's what we strive really, really hard for, to saving them time to not having to collect all the things, because that's in most cases. Well, I teach ocean trainings a lot. So I teach these 6-day courses where I literally tell people all the time, collecting is most of the times the easy part, but by far the most time consuming part, because now you need to scavenge the entire internet for all kinds of data nuggets. And then you create your own haystack with data, but you still need to find that nugget in that haystack that answers that intelligence requirement.
Yeah.
And well, I think so, this is what we did.
Another thing I jump in
totally true
to
totally
say,
true.
Nico, too, is, I mean, if when you have all those tools in one place, it's, I mean, everybody that's ever talked to me knows I've said this a million times, but like failing faster is good.
Yeah.
Like the faster you fail at that data, the faster you go, that
well,
didn't find
you're,
what I
you're
wanted.
Talking about the collection of the data versus the,
yes.
the actual
no, it's
tool
not just,
itself. Yeah.
It's not just that though. It's when you fail fast, you don't waste time building. Like, so what Nico described was, hey, I've got all this stuff. I found all these things. Okay. Now I have to sort them out.
Yeah.
What we do though, is we go in there and we say, this doesn't have data points. And
that's always been one of our big selling points in our private training that we've been providing for a very, very long time. Let's look at our watches right now and see when our competitors are going to start putting fail fast. We help you fail fast in their marketing in the next three to 6 months. Yeah. I'm trolling you guys, you know, like
it's true.
I know you guys listen to the podcast and copy our copy edit and
another thing that I wanted to get into. So for example, when we talk about this, I have a huge need to put things into a time perspective. So when I'm investigating, let's say, a group of individuals or something like that, and they set something at a certain moment in time, okay, it's great that I can grab all the posts from a platform or from multiple platforms, but it means nothing to me if I cannot correlate it to when they said it. Because that's so timelining as a feature in a platform is very uncommon in OSINT tools. And I've been totally in this game for 25 years, and we recently stepped up our game by delivering that capability by showing you these artifacts. And in just like you said, if I'm capable of showing something on a map in correlation with time and the people that are connected to it, now all of a sudden I can see that bigger picture that will help me pivot into that one target that means something to my investigation. And I think that's what separates, I
totally agree. And I think that that was a novel way to put together that perspective of time, time events and context that, you know, previously wasn't even on our radar, but that did emerge. And I think that's really helpful. I've actually hijacked a little bit of a few other time mining features that I didn't tell you guys about. So I just went to the product manager and did that this week. So there's going to be some other features pushed in there that are really important to me, just because I like to do lots and lots of manual stuff first. Yeah. So like, it's just like, you know, doing recon on, you know, a target network that you want to get into, spend 99% of your time on the recon. And I spend 99% of my time manually doing stuff before even, like, you know, I'll go read documents, plot out the entities manually, put those things in a timeline, you know, even in my own Excel spreadsheet, so I can have context.
Or collecting seed data in essence, right?
Right. Because some things are going to have timestamps on them, and then some things you're just going to know it happened at this time, and you don't know if it's correlated to the other events or other actors, right? But you still need to see, is there an overlap? And so some of those features have been put into the roadmap as well. So I spend tons of time on other forms of timelines that we don't have in there yet. But
and I think this is also cool. Why it's so important that we talk a lot with our customers, trying to get a better feel for what they need, because everybody is always looking for the silver bullet solution. And I will tell everybody who's listening, there will never be a silver bullet solution, but we will definitely try to build the next best thing by listening
to people. And I kind of want to caveat that I feel like this is the whole timelining of anything and everything, that is just investigative methodology. This has nothing to do with open source intelligence. You know, so like I was helping out with a murder investigation a few weeks ago, and you know, one of the bad guys had turned his phone off before he went to perform the crime. So, you know, it was just really like being able to map out like human nature. What did the guy do? When did he do it? Could we say for this entire city at, you know, 1 a.m. how many people in the entire city turn their phone off? There's probably going to be four guys, right? But let's timeline. Let's put that in our Excel spreadsheet. And that's just investigative stuff. And I feel like sometimes like the whole OSINT community like tags everything as OSINT, ourselves included, when really sometimes it's open source intelligence is just the output of a lot of other work, right? You know, and so that's kind of the niche where Horizon fits in between just investigative methodology, being able to go on the road, be in the field with the same capabilities on your phone, your iPad, and with somebody sitting next to you that may have more context, you know? So
I think that's the biggest capability.
Yeah.
You know, having to go on the road, right? Go mobile. Yeah. Because when you're, especially for military and law enforcement, if you're on the road, an austere environment, the fact that it's web-based platform, you can do, you know, battle damage assessment, figure out what, you know, what protests, what roads are closed on the go.
Yeah. And I mean, imagine if we would have had this out during the Afghanistan drawdown, we could have helped out people there much faster than us being the people behind the keyboards relaying the information at weird times. And I mean, it just would have been so much more helpful for anybody in that environment to be able to pick up the publicly available information.
Well, I can tell you an actual real world story based of that. At the beginning of the Ukraine war, I had a good friend who lives in the Netherlands, but she's from the US. She's a former US Intel person. She was helping them protect her digital infrastructure, but bombs started falling all around her.
Mm-hmm.
And she texted me. She's like, Nico, I need to get the F out of here. Can you help me? So I spun up our technology and I just started to look around where she was. So she basically shared her location through her phone, real time to my phone. So I knew exactly where she was. And I could point our technology to those intersections, those roads, just trying to figure out what kind of scatter was there, but also just getting a broader perspective of that province, that area that she was in. Where are the mm-hmm. Russians deployed? Where are roadblocks? And with that, I was able to get them safely to Moldova and even helping them and get a US basketball player out there just by purely using open source and shell. But most importantly, again, understanding time perspective and geospatial information to find what you need to find to get people safe. And I think that's a perfect case study of, hey, you have someone that is in a situation deployed in the field mm-hmm. right now. So imagine at that point, we didn't have that that mobile capability that David just said. Imagine that she was at feet on the ground there. All she basically had to do was open an iPad or a laptop with a internet connectivity, and she could have done this all herself. Just right. pushing two or three buttons, and she would get that situational awareness.
Yeah. I think, going beyond military and law enforcement, a lot of multinational companies have to use this as well too.
Yeah.
I mean, big think time. About supply chain and shipping. I know I was working in Congress when Russia invaded Ukraine, and Microsoft, banks, mm-hmm. Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, they all had to get their people out of Russia very fast. And so those kind of events, you've got to watch if you're a multinational company nowadays.
Yeah,
David, you're going to get me on my soapbox right now. I am absolutely, my mind is blown by the fact that we have airlines, we have, banks, we have all these people that have these incredibly power companies, all these things that have these incredibly sensitive positions, and they're not being able to see what people are ranting or saying, like online or in any kind of space that we grab data from. And it's just, it really, I mean, I fly all the time, and it's like every time I walk on a plane, I'm like, I really hope this person's not crazy that runs this plane. And it's like, we need to be doing this
I mean this guy kind of goes back to the old premise of some of the investigative rules that we always had in our workbook is, the more the luckier you get.
Yeah, it's magic, right?
Like it's really simple, so why wouldn't you start implementing publicly available information and open source intelligence into every area of your business just to know about competitive intelligence, what's going on in the landscape, supply chain. The use cases are, just think about everything that Google ever did when they first started. Like everybody's like, oh my gosh, why would you use a search engine? Now everyone uses a search engine. It's the same thing, right? Like, so I think in the next 3 years, this wave of publicly available information or open source intelligence, it's just going to be much more normalized as another business process for just about everything under the sun. Like, you want to hire somebody? Yep, let's check them out. Like, how many people have we checked out and just thought, wow, this guy is crazy. Like, we should cut this off at a 15-minute interview. We should have done this earlier. And that's not even getting to hiring a bad seed, right? Like that's just time management.
Yeah.
That's an excellent observation. We have done that a bunch of times. We're like, all right, that's not cool. Let's just keep moving.
You got to give the audience a little insight into the weird. Give us
Oh man.
Give us some. All right.
Dudes, stupid story. Right? So we always use our technology when we hire people. And
How did any of us get hired? I don't.
Yeah.
Well, you're not
part
a
of
complete.
operation
Yeah.
security.
Yeah. Well, none of us are deviants, right? Living in a basement either. So.
So we had this. We had an interview with this guy. We interviewed this guy, and every single time we do it. Any kind of, you know, hiring, we always do the quick social net kind of research thing. It's usually not extensive, but you know, we just kind of go see what we can find. And I'm on this call with this guy who's looking to be an intern, and I pull up his aliases, and every single one of them is somehow porn related. And yeah, I don't have a big problem with porn directly, but the comments were, I'm not going to say them on the podcast, but they were wild, like wild stuff. And I was just like, and this was a very good resume. This was a guy with a master's degree. I mean, he was doing pretty well. And
yeah.
I was just like, everything he had out there was, I would, most people wouldn't like it. I'll put it that way. And we were, yeah, he definitely had a hobby. That's a good way to say it.
Yeah.
We saw that, and on the call, I kicked it over to one of the other people that was doing the interview with me. And they were just like, oh my gosh, we got to get off this call right now. You know, like, and
like throw up in your mouth. Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. Weirdo. Like, we got to get out of here.
It's like HR violation just waiting to happen if that guy were to work at the office, you know, say or do something super inappropriate, just because so many weird things were normalized as just a normal appetite for his day. And I mean,
yeah, it was
that,
it was
or raging out on politics all the time, you know, like
well, and that's something else, actually. That's a really good point, Dan. A lot of times I look for that when we do this research. I look for extremism. And, you know, extremism comes in many forms. You know, if it's just constantly posting about politics, or constantly posting about, I don't know, rescuing cats, or, you know, whatever is their extreme thing they're just obsessed with, that usually tells you this person has obsessions, and it's easy, you know,
or
it's
a
easy.
Deficiency in something, right? I mean, like, there's a hole that's being filled in maybe an inappropriate way, you know?
Yeah. And I have no problem rescuing cats, by the way. I just, it's just sometimes you see people just get really, really overly focused on something. And it's like, that's a good indicator that if you have three people to talk to, you go, this person has this obsession, maybe they should go down that path. And
we
not,
need to save more cats, though. I mean, that's a good point.
No,
I mean,
I have no problem with saving. I have no problem with cats.
Like, David was just talking to me the other day. He's like, we should have a thing called cat games. You know,
OSINT for cats. Yeah,
OSINT for cats. OSINT for cats and
is
cat
this,
games.
Is
and
this based on the Netflix documentary?
No, I'm just totally. I'm just totally being silly. You know, like,
yeah, I mean, that being said, though, like, extremism is anytime you see, like, sort of a hyper focused obsession with something, you're probably dealing with somebody that, you know, depending on, it's hard to say what the role is. So, like, if the role is like I mentioned flight attendants earlier, like, you know, if they're obsessed with, you know, extremism and, you know, extremism around airlines, I wouldn't even say airlines. It'd be like
cats.
No,
cat,
I wouldn't even say
cat, cat extremism, like cat extremism, bad, you know.
But you know, well, if you're dealing with that, that's an issue. And I think that anybody that has you know, any kind of extremist view, it's pretty easy to see that with what we do. And
maybe make it realistic. Occupying high schools or schools because you have that seems to be a real thing in the past, let's say, couple of weeks.
You mean hours? But yeah,
and weeks. Well, let's say in the U.S. it started now, the past hours. In Europe, it has been ongoing for a couple of weeks now, where people try to sit into a school hall because they have an opinion, and they have a right to an opinion. That's, don't get me wrong here. But just seeing how people, you were talking about extremism, how they started off, let's say, fairly neutral, having their opinion, but not feeling heard or not getting the podium that they expected. You can literally track them through open sources and seeing them become more and more radical almost after every rally or protest where people are. And that counts for both sides of the medal.
No, so, it's true. It's yeah. It's 100% true. And that's what I'm getting at is identifying extremism, identifying the obsession is easy to see with what we do. And that's the powerful aspect of things. And there's obviously tons of nuance here. Like we were joking about cats, but there's an enormous amount of sort of human interaction that we can see quickly that you don't see from an interview or talking to a supplier or interviewing someone. You know, you don't see that. And that's really where the power comes from, is the ability to allow someone to make those observations. And that's the thing, is no matter what we're doing, it's always a human interaction. It's always going to be some sort of a, no matter who it is, it's a human interaction that we're doing. And so when we see it in the tool, we can go, oh,
don't forget, spontaneous, right? But when you track these things, they're way less spontaneous as you would think, because you can see certain faces, let's say, in different locations where they should not be. So they travel across countries.
Oh, yeah, they definitely do. We've seen that.
It's very telling about what the agenda is, who they are connected to, and what the group is. And when you start looking into their financial trails, which you can also find online, this is when you can start seeing, let's say, that there is a bigger agenda going on with certain groups. And you can even doubt that if the rally that where you spot them now, if that is their actual agenda, or if they're just trying to get people there to turn to their other agenda.
Yeah.
Because that's what's happening. That's what I'm seeing at least a lot currently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's somebody was on, I can't remember. It was FDD. Somebody was on TV the other day talking about, well, all the tents are the same in these protests. You know, somebody's funding these, and you know, a lot of the amplification that you see in social media is coming from a couple big sources, right? So that's one indicator right there.
We've absolutely seen
that,
David.
Or they make mistakes where they say on camera that they pay people to come to their protest.
Yeah.
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 I've seen that a bunch too.
I was trying to talk about cats, and you guys went straight into the.
What social media provider do you think is like the most or the worst on creating the echo chamber for the masses? I mean, and I'm saying,
should I go on record saying this?
Dude, it doesn't.
It's 100% TikTok.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, that's. What do you think, David? I mean, I'm definitely not on TikTok, but
yeah, I'm not on TikTok either. There's been a lot of the reports that have come out, you know, surrounding some of the legislation that was passed, actually just signed into law. So there's a lot of stats out there on what the TikTok algorithm pushes, but funneling people, you know, through the southern border, pro-Palestine, anti-Israel type information, that is, you know, 10 to 1 versus cat videos, just to use the cat video example. But yeah, I mean, there's really no argument here that China is manipulating this. And why wouldn't they? It's in their benefit to see everyone protests and campuses on pro-Palestine, push them towards violence, push, you know.
Do you guys think that some of the stuff that's happening on the campuses is going to get pushed over the edge to violence, much like in the 60s and 70s in Ohio and stuff like that? I mean, like
it,
to
it
me,
already
it already
has.
Okay, like how
they beat some girl up today.
Really?
Yeah, they just arrested 100 people in Colombia this morning. They had they raided one of the libraries. Some of the protesters were occupying a campus building, and they had to go in and pull them all out.
Wow, and I didn't know. This week in the Netherlands, I'm behind today. Sorry, guys.
This week's in the Netherlands, we have the remembrance of the World War II, which we always do on the 4th of May. So may the 4th be with them all. And it's the first time actually that the Dutch mayor and the Dutch, let's say the triangle, that's the official triangle that makes the decision, is the mayor, the Supreme Court, and law enforcement. They made a call that you have to sign up. You have to sign up to be part of that remembrance on the Dam Square in Amsterdam. It has never happened before. Why? Because they know there will be people that are willing to protest and disturb that 2 minutes of silence and protesting. That by itself is very telling that we're living in a very polarized time where people don't are no longer willing to respect each other's history anymore. And I think that by itself for me is very disturbing. Yes, there's things going on that part of the world that are very wrong. And we all oppose to that. But you still have to respect that, for example, my country, we lost millions and millions of people. The Holocaust, that's not your moment. Those 2 minutes are to remember the fallen. And if you want to shout and protest, do that the day after, not on that day. And those are these things, just like these occupations of these universities, where I'm very amazed that these universities don't take a stance in this. They're just watching and standing by. I'm like, what's going on here? Why aren't you guys? And everybody has a right to an opinion, but there's time and a place for an opinion, and that's not in the study hall.
Especially barricading a building. And going back to kind of the TikTok thing, you know, one of my frustrations that I've seen as we've researched this over the last few years is, Nico, you actually made a good point of it. You talked about, you know, the history of people and where they've been and that kind of thing. And, you know, I think that TikTok is designing filter bubbles. We know they exist.
Echo chambers.
Echo chambers, but we're losing what I would call especially for, you know, sort of, I would say free countries, you know, good free places, not bad places like North Korea or something. But we used to share a sort of, cultural identity, you know, movies, music, all that kind of stuff. If I said, hey, you know, who are the Beatles? You could say, it's Ringo. It's these guys. And, I think that the internet has created a lot of filter bubbles. Now I'm a gamer. I love video games. There's a little Nintendo 64 behind me, and you know, I love that kind of stuff. And so like my filter bubble is a little different than other people's, but I believe that what's happening with TikTok, and I believe governments, is they've recognized that exists, and that's being co-opted to create exactly what you described. You know, we talk about these protests in the US, they all kind of happened at the same time, you know, and that's pretty obvious
that's pretty weird, you know.
And that's really where the power of these groups come from. They can take a look at an algorithm. They can, I mean, me and Nico have done an enormous amount of research on AI stuff over the last few months, and we can grab the data from things and we can say, what is the story here? What is it? Okay, I don't want anything that has that story. I want this story. I want to push this story up. And so I think that there is a lot of very nefarious actors, you know, influencing this kind of stuff. And I also think corporations as well, you know, they're pushing fake drugs and stuff like that. But you know, that's, Nico, what you said about, you know, the history of the Netherlands, like, the Netherlands was in a horrible situation just 60 something years ago, you know, 70, maybe my math is bad, but then they're remembering that situation, and then people are, you know, people will try to co-opt that. And so that can easily be controlled by those filter bubbles. And that's something to think about,
Well, it also has to do with perception, right? Because we now have a generation that has little to no understanding of what happened almost, I think it's now 70 years ago. So their worldview is so vastly different than my mm-hmm. worldview. Let's say my parents' worldview, let's say my grandparents' worldview. Yeah. Their biases and logical fallacies are so vastly different than mine just because they were raised in a different time, in a different world, in essence. It makes them look so much differently at the world. And this is where I think certain threat actors in certain countries and nation states are very smart at targeting these people in their already echo chambers to, again, fill in those little blanks that they left open.
Yeah, yeah. There's really two, I mean, I'm going to generalize here, but there's two levels of input. There's the external output or external input where you get from human interaction, and then there's your internal dialogue that can kind of process this kind of stuff. And Nico, you've talked about, you know, digital inputs manifesting themselves in the physical world. You talked about being in Times Square for the first time, I think a couple podcasts ago. But when both of those inputs come from your phone or from someone else who's pushing that to you, then I think that's when you get these mass movements. And you have to wonder, why are all these protests that are turning violent happening on college campuses and not, you know, in the streets of Times Square? I get there's protests.
Or in the suburbs of a southern state, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's like, right. That's
because
right.
If that were to happen, I mean, yeah, I mean, even go look at 2020, right? Like,
yeah,
how many riots did you have in southern states where everyone's armed to the teeth? Not many. There wasn't many in Alabama, I can tell you that, right? Like, there wasn't that many in Texas. The stuff in Austin got squashed real quick. The stuff in San Antonio squashed real quick. And then it just moved on to other states, right? So it's, you know, the deterrence there was pretty interesting. And so it did seem like it wasn't organic. It looked directed towards places that were weaker and, you know, definitely not in the suburbs where angry moms and dads are going to come out and be like, hell no, you know?
Yeah. You know, David, that's an interesting concept, though. I mean, it's not in our notes here, but, you know, the internal dialogue of people is, you know, it's obviously getting co-opted. And that's something I hadn't really thought about until you just said that right now. Like,
yeah, David, could you share more about some of that information and in that way of thinking about the internal dialogue being overwritten, kind of?
Well, yes, I can. Someday, someday I'm going to finish this book. But
I'm reading that too. I'm behind though.
So, Jacques Ellul talks about mass society and individual society. So that's where I kind of, you know, there's the human interaction, which I think for me is having a conversation with the people around you, your small groups, either whether it's work or school or church or wherever around the dinner table, where you can bounce ideas off of them and someone goes, oh, that's a great idea. Or, hey, that's not a good idea. You probably shouldn't participate in that protest that mm-hmm. you think you're going to do. And then the internal dialogue, you know, I think is, let me think here. So the external input is two way, right? The internal dialogue is only one way, I think. And what I mean by that is that your internal dialogue happens obviously internally. You go out and talk about it, and then that influences, you know, it's a feedback loop, basically.
Right.
Yes.
So I look at the college campuses, and I never spent time on a college campus when I was in school. I did it, you know, in the Army, which is much different. It's kind of like a self-licking ice cream cone when you're walking around on campus. And if you're looking at TikTok and Instagram and you're in your, you know, in your bubble, then that's going to feed your internal dialogue and then manifest itself in the physical environment.
Yeah,
and
I
then
agree with you.
That's where
yeah,
you
yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I actually had this. This actually kind of made me think of a conversation I had with my daughter last night. She asked me, she didn't want to go to a softball tournament this weekend. I said, why don't you want to go? She goes, my coach is stupid. My coach is an idiot. And we both agree on that. So the boys at her school, they have two AAA baseball players as coaches. The girls don't. They have a coach that's not very good, in my opinion. And I think most people agree with that. But she said to me, I don't want to go to the softball tournament. I said, why don't you want to go? She goes, coach sucks. We're going to lose. I was like, well, let's get good at the game. How are we going to do that? And I gave her some options a few weeks ago. I said, why don't you just ask to go to the boys' practice? And she didn't do it, which is a whole nother issue. But she didn't want to go have the struggle with her teacher and all that. But thing is, her mind has been co-opted by those girls on that softball team. And I told her, you know, me and her, we play video games every night. I'm a gamer and we play Overwatch and we get in games where we're just getting wrecked by the other team. And she'll get upset and be like, hey, this guy can't, you know, he can't shoot. He stinks, or, you know, he's a bad DPS or whatever we're doing. And I'll be like, we have to figure out a way to win without that, like without that guy. He's not part of the team. We have to figure out how to do it. And sometimes we don't, and sometimes we do. And every now and then we turn the tide at the end of a fight and we win the game. And it's us doing it. And it's the mindset of doing that. And one of the things about the mindset of what you're talking about is it's sort of a lemmings mindset, right? Yeah. You know, anybody that looks at my alias online, you notice it has a lemming in it. And it's like being able to recognize that you are in that bubble and you are a lemming in that system. That's really the strength of something. And she was falling into that pattern. Sure, her team was like, this coach sucks, and they know she sucks. She's not very good. And, you know, getting out of that is to say, what do I need to do to solve this problem? And so when you describe what you just said about walking on a campus and looking at a phone, there's never a thought process to get out of that. And so this is more of a human conversation, I think, right now about it. It's just like, we have to train kids. We have to train young people. We have to train everybody. Step away, like put your phone down, you know, like look at the world, go meet a homeless person, you know, I actually had a call yesterday. Some of the guys were like, oh, Ellie was just talking to homeless people in New Orleans. And it's like, yeah, because I don't like, if we don't get out of our bubbles, we'll fall victim to that weakness. So I think your internal monologue thing being co-opted by the external thing is, man, that's a powerful concept. You know, it's as simple as not liking your coach in a softball game, and then it turns into the whole internet controls my life. That's horrifying.
Yeah. So I just think if you can replace one or the other or both of the either internal monologue or mass society or the external, which I think a lot of people have done, then that's where you get these mass protests. And ask some of these college kids what they're actually protesting, and they don't really know.
Yeah, that's really weird. That people protesting and not knowing why, that's so weird, you know?
I think it's what David's saying. Their internal mind has sucked up this concept and is just feeding that
no,
in there.
They're basically just pushed around by whatever.
They just want to be heard. They want to have that 1 minute of clout fame. They just want to have, you can see me at that protest. So now
that's another good point. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to like roll back a little bit. Elliot, you'd kind of mentioned mindset, right? I mean, basically. And I think that that's really important for folks that want to be investigators, is to think about the mindset, as well as entrepreneurs or hackers, right? Or anything that you're going to apply your hand to. Like, you don't need to have any external validation to go forth and conquer what's in front of you, right? And so, like, a lot of, I think a lot of society right now says, oh, you should have all this, you know, all these people agreeing with you to get you to the right area that you want to be. And it's kind of like this group think, collective group think, when really, like, mindset is everything in winning. So Elliot and I went to a private school growing up, and while it didn't have maybe the best curriculum, it did have a big stress on, if you got an 89, it's an F. And we just thought that was normal, right? Like, I didn't know that I thought I was a bad student, right? Because I was in the 94, I was like a 94 percentage, 94, 95% average, right? Versus the kids who were in the hundreds. So, like, Elliot was in the hundreds club, right? So I was like not that cool.
I don't need this on the podcast, dude.
Yeah, well, but it runs into a lot of things, from being an entrepreneur, an investigator, a hacker, problem solving things in front of you. You really have to believe that you are going to win, and be surprised when you lose. That's always been my mindset. And I remember, you know, as I shifted that mindset into, you know, remote exploitation of systems that I was going after early in my career, you know, the amount of winning and the amount of compromise and the amount of things that I had success in went up significantly when I always expected to win, right? And I totally identified that as not just a subtle mindset, but a complete overwhelming mindset, right? Of, I should be surprised when I lose, right? And so, you know, we've done that a lot with the tools that we brought to the market and the way that we run our business. But from an investigative perspective, you know, you should be surprised if the data doesn't tell you the story the right way. Like, I mean, it's not you fitting a narrative into your investigation. It's about you putting together all the puzzle pieces. It's about you asking the right questions to get the right answers. It's about so many different things, but really it has to do with mindset to begin with. Like, you're going to jump in the deep end and just persevere until the end on whatever the task is. And I think that's just really important. And I'm, you know, the mindset on the input, how that relates to that is just forget about external validation or external affirmation. It doesn't really matter what other people think. And many times when you share a new idea of innovation with somebody, they're going to poo-poo all over it because it wasn't their idea. So, I mean, anyway, those are just, I'm going on a little monologue there.
It's an accurate thing, man. It's and that's feeding back directly into what David was talking about, is the mindsets. Mindsets are what get people there. And we can clearly see that, you know, places like TikTok and things like that are guiding people into those weaker mindsets to not get out of the stream, you know, get out of the, what's the Dory and Nemo or whatever, you know, with the flow. Don't do that.
Yeah,
you know,
like,
I have to remember to do that. I have to not do that, you know? And so that's a very good observation. And David, that thought's actually something I guess we haven't really talked about too much, but that's a very interesting concept to think about, you know, an internal monologue kind of, you know, you got to control, you have to, they're kind of related to each other. And that's, mm-hmm. that's an interesting thing to think about, and the effect on where we're at.
If you look at that internal monologue, and if you put that in retrospect, so let's say pre-internet, you could have an internal monologue with yourself and have a very strong opinion about something. But the only way to get confirmation about that was to either go out to a library and find confirmation,
yeah.
or get in a fight.
Yeah, or find peers physically in the world to form a group. And that was way harder. So self-radicalization, let's say 25, 30 years ago, was way harder, if not nearly impossible. Now, all you need to do is have Wi-Fi and you can self-radicalize.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, it's interesting. But it's, I stole this from Ray Dalio, who talks about investing. He made a huge mistake, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s, when he started his hedge fund in his apartment. But he talks about, I stopped thinking I'm right and asking myself, how do I know I'm right? And I think, you know, I always took that with me downrange when I was deployed to you know, doing investigations or looking at, you know, networks or targeting or funding or whatever. Nico, you talk a lot about it too, I think, in some of your mindset material as well. But that's powerful. And that's a powerful critical thinking tool that you really have to, you're not born with that. I'll tell you that. You got to learn it, right? And I think losing helps with that as well. You have to have the self-awareness.
Or you have kids and a wife that tells you that's a dumb idea. Or that's a bad joke, dad. Those are a bunch of dumb dad jokes.
Yeah.
So
I had an argument with a four-year-old this morning over the location of her milk cup and whether or not she would drink it. So
yeah.
Definitely challenges you.
Yeah. We all have been in that situation. I think that's good. It keeps you sharp, right? We all have those good partners next to us that will tell us, hey, take a step back here.
Yeah.
And I also think that that's a very good wrap up of this podcast. Just that every investigator needs to have a solid someone next to them to tell them every now and then to take a break or to focus or to not focus on something.
Yeah.
That's right.
Have your significant other read your report without telling them anything about it for them to just be like, so how did you get from A to D? Well, it's obvious. Not to me.
Yep. That's the golden truth, the devil's advocate trick with your partner. That's, or at least someone that doesn't have, let's say, the skill set you have. That is the golden rule to a solid outcome.
Love it.
All right, gents. Thanks for this episode again. And well, I encourage people that are listening, if you have an opinion on what we say, or if you want to share something, if you know someone that you think that we should talk to, let us know. We'd be happy to bring someone on board. And for now, thanks for listening. On to the next one.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.